school reform, what's the best approach, top down or bottom up?
This was such an upheaval in the way education had been experienced in Newark, and because it was done without input from the parents or the teachers or the community, it led to a huge explosion. And one of the mayoral candidates had a press conference the day after the plan was unveiled, and he was standing in front of one of the high schools, a very historic Newark high school that was slated to close, and said this is an attack on public education.
That's Dale Russikoff. We talk with her about her acclaimed new book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools. Then,
while the rest of the country was intensifying its top-down reforms, San Francisco Unified tried something different, and they empowered their teachers. So they supported a small group of experienced teacher leaders to come up with reforms of their own. And they look very different than the top-down approach.
That's Christina Rizga. Her book tells the inspiring story of an inner-city high school in San Francisco. It's called Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. With all the massive use of high-stakes testing and holding teachers and schools to strict account, American students aren't doing so great. Recent nationwide scores are lower on math and reading. But even if scores were up, would that mean schools were really better? And who gets to decide? The growing involvement in the school reform movement of some of the biggest names in corporate America begs a question asked in the subtitle of Dale Russikoff's new book, The Prize, to wit, who's in charge of America's schools? And the corollary, what's the best way to improve failing schools, especially those in poor communities of color? The education philanthropists, like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, along with a number of hedge fund billionaires, think schools should be run like corporations. They want top-down control and strict accountability. Teachers and their unions are seen as the problem. The solution? An industrial education complex made up of highly paid consultants, testing services, and privatized charter schools. As we'll see later in the show, another approach is gaining ground, one that's driven by teachers and focused on students. But in The Prize, the title refers to Newark's school budget, Dale Russikoff tells the story of how a governor, a mayor, and a business tycoon devised a plan to remake Newark's public schools from the top down, and what happened. The lessons drawn from her book are vital to understanding what really works and doesn't if we want to give all of America's kids a good education. Dale Russikoff was a longtime reporter for The Washington Post, covering politics, education, and social policy. While at the Post's New York Bureau, she covered the New York City metropolitan area, including Newark, New Jersey. She begins The Prize with then-Newark Mayor Cory Booker and Governor Chris Christie sharing a ride in Cory Booker's SUV. During the ride, they hatch a plan to reform Newark schools that soon led to Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook giving a record $100 million to the effort. I asked Russikoff how it came about that Booker and Christie were even in the position to hatch the plan.
The way that this came about was that Governor Christie had control of the Newark schools. For 15 years, the state had complete control of the schools because the state took over the schools in 1995 after an investigation that found massive corruption at the top and severe neglect of children throughout the system. So there was no local control. The mayor had no authority. The school board was only advisory. Everything rested in the governor's hands and in the hands of his education commissioner. So if Cory Booker wanted to do anything about the schools, he had to appeal to Christie for help.
So what was the state of Newark schools then? What was going on?
Starting in 1995, when the state took over the schools, they had been in a state of neglect of the kids. At the time that the state did its investigation and took over the schools, there was a line in the investigative report that said it all, and it said, the longer children remain in the Newark public schools, the less likely they are to succeed. As children advanced, each grade had lower and lower and lower performance on the state tests. And the state had been in control for 15 years, but very little had improved in that time, even though the state had not returned the schools to Newark to try to do better on its own. So that was an issue that was just a tremendous flashpoint in Newark. Why is the state still here when they haven't improved our schools? At the time that this $100 million gift was made by Mark Zuckerberg, in the kindergarten through eighth grade schools in Newark, fewer than 40% of children were reading at grade level. And in the high school, just a little over half of the students were graduating. And of those who graduated and then went on to the local community college, 90% needed to take remedial courses before qualifying for college-level work. So there was just a tremendous amount of failure all throughout the system.
Now, these schools are pretty segregated, aren't they?
Yes. The city is, the school district is 95% black and brown students. So the schools are, there's, you know, just a concentration of minority kids in all the schools.
So this was not just about reforming Newark. In fact, at least in Cory Booker's mind, the idea was that Newark would become, I think, did he call it a hemisphere of hope?
He called it that, and he said that it would be a proof point that districts all across the country could use and adopt the model of what was done in Newark so that urban school districts, the implication or the promise was that in Newark they would come up with a model for solving the problems of education in all urban districts, and that this approach that they took in Newark could then be taken to one city after the next, and with Zuckerberg's philanthropy, it could be implemented nationally to solve the problems of all urban schools in the United States. It was a pretty audacious promise.
One might even call it hubristic.
Yes, there was a lot of hubris. They kept using the phrase, we know what works, with the implication that the people who've been running the schools all these years don't, and that, you know, we need to replace them as the decision makers and impose reform from the top down. And that was very much the approach that was taken. Now, they felt that they had to do it this way because had there been, according to Cory Booker and Christie and Christie's education commissioner, Christopher Cerf, who had been very involved in education reform in New York City under the Chancellor Joel Klein, they all said that if you made this an open participatory reform process, it would be taken captive by unions and political bosses and the forces defending the status quo, and nothing would happen. So their view was, in order to serve the children, we have to circumvent the existing powers that be.
You present a kind of clash of ideologies, of two ideologies of how to approach school reform. And I'm not really using ideology necessarily as a bad thing, but one idea being that teachers are at fault, and the other idea, maybe you can articulate the other idea.
Well, the other idea, I guess, you know, maybe coming from teachers' unions would be that the problems that students have in their lives outside of school make it very difficult for teachers to reach them, and that they would without more support, children can't reach the levels of success and excellence that the reformers are seeking for them.
Now, the first idea, the ideology, is one that's very much promoted by what you call venture philanthropy, and Mark Zuckerberg's $100 million would go squarely in this. Talk about the idea of venture philanthropy, even larger than Zuckerberg, and then how, you know, he was part of this trend, this idea.
Well, in the last 15 years, there's been a transition in the leading philanthropies in education. For most of the last century, the philanthropies of the industrialists from the turn of the 20th century dominated education. So this, or education giving anyway. So this would have been the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, to another extent the Annenberg Foundation, and the Lilly Foundation. And these have all been displaced as the leading foundations in education since the turn of the 21st century, and living billionaires have become the predominant givers. And that would be Bill Gates, the Walton family of the Walmart fortune, California's Eli Broad, the Fisher family of the Gap fortune, Michael Dell of Dell Computers. And they are known as venture philanthropists because they bring the ideas of venture capital to their giving. They want to see results, and they want to give money in very targeted ways in order to have specific changes in the existing system. They want a return on their giving, and the return is, as they call it, transformation in the way education is delivered. So they're very, very active in expanding charter schools. They've also been funding new teacher evaluation systems that will now, in many states, evaluate teachers based on their student test scores, you know, a much more narrow metric than previous evaluations were based on. And they're, because of the Eli Broad Foundation has been training superintendents to manage school districts the way a high-performing business would operate. So that's, you know, changes in human resources and development of a state-of-the-art data system that can hold everyone accountable for student performance at all levels of the school district. And so these are the kind of targeted things that they're pushing in hopes of changing education. It's called systems, you know, the approach is called systems change, changing the management systems in education in hopes that if you get the incentives right and the management right, that change will trickle down into the classroom.
Changing the systems, I mean, that's so interesting because it seems like they left a whole lot out of looking. I mean, if you're thinking about systemic thinking, they actually tried to cut the community out of the decision making. And that's part of the system, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. And, you know, the community, that includes the parents of the children whose lives you're trying to change. So there was a real problem built into it. But another thing is that by focusing on the systems, the management systems at the top of the education system, you're not focusing on the classroom where learning happens and where teachers actually have to reach children. And in Newark in particular, and in many urban districts where there's a lot of poverty and violence that kids negotiate every day, there needs to be tremendous emphasis on what it takes to support the kids and the teachers so that learning can happen in spite of all of those terrible distractions.
Right. And I will be asking you that in a moment about that, because you do contrast this approach to another one that's much more bottom-up in the community. But before we get to that, you know, one of the things I wonder about in this venture philanthropy is giving a lot of money away, but it's also has led to the creation of hugely profitable testing systems, consultants. I mean, in fact, the high fees of consultants were paid during this Newark reform effort became quite controversial.
Yes. When there's a lot of venture philanthropy in a district, they usually concentrate, I mean, they do concentrate in districts where the governor is in charge of the school, say, in like in New Jersey, or there are state-controlled districts within various communities, like in Memphis and in Nashville. The lowest-performing schools are under state control. And so where there's a reform-friendly governor in charge of the schools, or where there's a chancellor who's a reformer, that's where the venture philanthropy is invested the most. And they do tend to use the same consulting firms, and they charge the consulting firms charge top dollar. They're big management consulting firms with education specialties, and a lot of the people who worked in Newark got $1,000 a day while they were doing this work. And it did become a huge issue in Newark, the city of extremely high poverty, and the idea that people who, you know, white, multi-degreed people from outside are coming in and making all this money in the name of saving our children became a very hot political issue.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dale Russakoff about the ambitious plan to remake Newark's failing schools, funded by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and promoted by then-Mayor Cory Booker and Governor Chris Christie. Her book is The Prize.
Right, and also part of the idea that you talk about in the book is that money that could have gone to the district schools actually was siphoned off from the public sphere toward the private sphere, not just in terms of consultants, but in terms of charter schools and in other ways as well.
There was a very clear and intentional part of the plan was to expand the charter schools in Newark, and that was because the existing charter schools included two very large networks of schools that had extremely fine results in student performance, you know, in terms of their math and English test scores and in their matriculation to college. And so the thinking was, let's develop more of these schools so that we have more kids succeeding in school and going to college. And that was done, and those kids very likely are going to benefit for the rest of their lives as a result of this. The thing is that they reached a level of 40% of students in charter schools in Newark, which means that 60%, a good majority of students, are still in the district schools. And as students left for charter schools, the money follows them, and so the district schools are in a terrific financial crisis now. They've had to close and consolidate schools, lay off teachers, lay off staff, take thousands of children and move them around because their school buildings are no longer open. And the unfortunate result is that performance in the district schools from kindergarten through eighth grade has gone down significantly. In two grades, reading scores are down 9 points. In two grades, they're down 6 points. So, you know, there's a collateral damage problem that, you know, the sort of excitement about charter schools didn't take into account.
And yet there was a school and a person named Princess Williams and also other people in her school. This is the Avon Avenue School, a district school that you write about in this wonderful book, The Prize, Dale Russakoff. Tell us about their approach, so different from the one that you've just outlined coming from the venture philanthropists.
Yes, well, their approach was to take the existing school with all the children in it and try to turn it around by working with the teachers who were already there and developing their skills and their ability to reach children of all types in the classroom. They built a lot of support into professional development for teachers, and they rearranged the principal's job so that her primary responsibility was to be in the classroom observing and coaching teachers and giving them feedback on how to better reach all the kids in the classroom. And they did get some very significant results, but unfortunately that school still has a very, very low student achievement. And the Princess Williams was the lead kindergarten teacher in this group. There was a group of teachers that led the turnaround of the school. It was a teacher-led school, which was another unusual feature of it. And she was an absolutely extraordinary teacher who herself had grown up in conditions very similar to those of the children in the school. That school had one of the poorest catchment areas of any school in Newark. And so she had a lot of children in her class who were homeless, whose families were, you know, dealing with violence on a regular basis and just a lot of instability. And she understood that intuitively and felt very strongly that she wanted to be there for those kids and to be a teacher who could help those children navigate this kind of childhood in Newark. Now, the unfortunate thing was that as the charter schools expanded and the district schools had to make cutbacks, that school lost a lot of its social support services, social and emotional supports for kids. And at the end of the time that I was researching the book, she had a class of 26 kindergarten children in which 15 had child welfare cases. You know, they were being monitored by the state because of neglect or exposure to violence or exposure to drugs or not getting enough to eat. And she became so concerned about her inability to manage all these kids, she had asked the district to send her an extra aide because some of the children at age 5 were so angry they threw chairs and they hit children and they were unable to learn, and they so frightened some of the other children in the class that those children were unable to learn. And the district said it couldn't provide her with an extra aide, and I think it took 8 months before she finally got the help she needed. So she made a very, very tough decision to go to a charter school at the end of that year, and found that they got many more resources to the classroom and school level than the district did. So she had a class. She was teaching an inclusion class, which means that she had kids with special needs. And she found that there were children in that class who had trauma, and in some cases comparable to the worst cases in her district school class. But because that school had 3 social workers, when she had any kind of issue in the class, she just texted the social worker, and within hours, somebody came to help her, to help observe this child and figure out what was needed and then provide it. So that was a very significant development and a big difference between what the district schools, what kind of resources they were getting to the classroom versus how this one particular charter school was managing its resources. It doesn't mean that every charter school is like that, but this one had used the flexibility to develop a lot more support at the school level for kids who were in need.
It's such a powerful story, and the story of what was attempted to be done, and successes, real successes that were then undermined. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dale Rusakoff about her book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? What was the response of the community to this plan?
Well, the plan as it was, the plan was rolled out in its final form in the summer and fall of 2014, and it was called One Newark, and it sounded like a very unifying plan, at least if you just listen to the name, but it turned out to be a very divisive plan because it was an attempt to right-size this district that had lost so many students to the charters, and also because now there were going to be 40% of children in charters, it was creating what was called a universal enrollment system, so that no longer would anyone automatically go to his or her neighborhood school that was just walking distance away. And that was the way education had been organized in Newark for over 100 years. It's a city of small neighborhood schools that everyone could easily walk to from home. Under the new system, children and parents would apply to the school they wanted anywhere in the city, whether it was a charter school or a district school. And the idea here was to make it just as easy to get into a charter school as a district school, instead of having what had been a pretty significant selection bias for the most motivated parents back when the charter schools had lotteries. Mm-hmm. But the effect of all this, and it also involved closing schools and consolidating schools and turning a number of schools over to charter schools, and this was such an upheaval in the way education had been experienced in Newark, and because it was done without input from the parents or the teachers or the community, it led to a huge explosion. And one of the mayoral candidates had a press conference the day after the plan was unveiled, and he was standing in front of one of the high schools, a very historic Newark high school that was slated to close, and said, "This is an attack on public education." Mm-hmm. And it was such a visual of this candidate surrounded by, you know, state senators and council members and the presidents of every union that represented workers in the school district, and this iconic the background, that it really did just kind of turn this into a battlefield. And later the superintendent backed off of closing that high school, but it was as if the horse was out of the barn. And the whole mayoral campaign, this was the campaign to replace Cory Booker. He had gone to the Senate and his term had expired. And the candidate who was running against the reforms won by a large margin, even though the education reform movement nationally put over $5 million into the campaign of the person running against it.
And that was Ross Baraka, who became mayor of Newark and had been the principal of one of the major high schools in Newark. So after you reported this incredible story, I mean, this was one of the earlier campaigns to use venture philanthropy to reform school systems. I mean, these still go on. I believe that the widow of Steve Jobs has just announced, she's been very involved with this and has announced a new effort out in California. What's the major takeaway that you got from reporting this story about school reform and how to do it?
Well, a couple of things. I do feel that anyone who is going to try to reform a school district needs to know that school district intimately from the bottom up, not just from the top down. And that, you know, in Newark there was no involvement of people who had taught in the school district, gone to the schools in Newark. This was all planned by people outside the system. And even though, you know, their concern was that, well, those in the system are responsible for the problems in it, there are, in any failing school, excellent teachers who are struggling every day to reach kids in spite of the obstacles that the system poses. And those are the people who know intimately what the schools need to change. Mm-hmm. And if those people aren't involved, you're going to miss some really important elements of what it takes to turn around a school district. And then I think the other piece of it is that by focusing just on the systems management issues at the top, thinking that you can change education from the top, you're missing another incredibly important point, because what happens in the classroom between kids and teachers is just, well, that is education. Mm-hmm. And that it has to, it takes working every day. Some days you don't succeed, some days you do. You keep coming back and figuring out what you did wrong and making it better. And children change, and you have to adjust to those changes. And those are the kinds of things that a top-down model or a proof point can't even contemplate.
Well, that's terrific. And your terrific book is The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? Dale Russikoff, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. It was great to be with you.
Dale Russikoff. Read more from Russikoff about the plan to reform Newark schools at writersvoice.net. Next up, we learn about a high school that's changing students' lives from the bottom up. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Dale Russikoff's The Prize shows the failure of taking a top-down approach to school reform. Well, Christina Rizka's inspiring new book, Mission High, shows what a bottom-up approach, driven by great teachers and focused on students' needs, can do. Mission High is in the heart of San Francisco's Mission District. The school is highly diverse, a rarity in itself. But there is unity in diversity. The school is a real community, brought together by a common commitment to excellence and to supporting each student's path to learning. Test scores aren't high, partly because so many kids are English language learners. Many students also contend with all the stresses poverty and racism bring, as well as the legacy of the poor schools they came from. But as Rizka shows, their academic work is not only up to par, but often far in advance of other kids their age. And that makes all the difference also in how they feel about themselves. How this happens is vividly told through the stories of the students and teachers in Rizka's book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph.
Well, Christina Rizka, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's really great to be on your show.
You spent 4 years at Mission High School in San Francisco researching this book. It seems like a truly wonderful school. Give us a snapshot of the school just to begin.
Yeah, so it's an incredibly diverse school. It's one of the most diverse schools in the country. There are students who speak 48 languages there. It's a school that, like many our urban schools, educates very high numbers of low-income students. 75% of students are poor. 45% of students are Latino. 15% are African-American. 25% Asian-American. And 40% of students are English learners, which means that they've been speaking English for less than 2 years. And while the, you know, according to its performance on standardized test scores, it's not doing that great, and it was, you know, placed on a list of low performing schools. When you look at other quantitative and qualitative data, it's very hard to label it, this school, as failing. So, for example, even though it educates so many low-income students, 75% of students are enrolled in colleges this year. Nationally, for poor students, that number is usually around 55%. Graduation rates are some of the highest in the district. Attendance is very high. 90% of students in surveys and parents also say that they like the school and would recommend it to others. It's a much higher average percentage than, you know, other district schools that often post, you know, much higher test scores. And then there's a lot of qualitative things, and this is really what I, you know, the reason why I wrote the book. I wanted to kind of highlight all these invisible qualities that outsiders don't see, but of course schools and communities see every day. So, for example, if you walk into Mission High School, right off the bat, you're just going to notice that there are high standards. There's, you know, staff that's incredibly committed. There's a lot of love and care within the building. And you also notice that even though it's a very diverse school, it actually has very little segregation within the school, which I've certainly seen in other diverse schools in the country. So, and it has to do, you know, those are very deliberate designs within the school to create more integrated classes, to make sure that Latino and African American students have access to honors and AP classes. There's a lot of multicultural clubs. And so you don't see the typical, you know, segregation along racial lines that you would see in other environments with teenagers in other schools. There's just this sense that students view themselves, you know, they're not there to kind of just, you know, get to the next thing. There's a real sense of community and leadership. And, you know, every student seems to be involved in volunteering or running a club or solving some kind of a problem within a school. So there's incredible student engagement academically, but also in terms of their community.
It wasn't always like this. The school, Mission High, at one time was quite troubled. There was even a legal suit against it in the 1990s, I believe, brought by a student for not serving its students adequately. What turned Mission High around?
That's a great question. You know, I think that Mission High School, in many ways, and San Francisco District is a little bit ahead of our country in terms of its approach and understanding of school reforms. For decades, the way the district was reforming its school would remind you very much of what Dale Rusakov describes in her book, The Prize. It was essentially, you know, top-down reforms and a lot of expensive consultants. So in the mid-90s, for example, citing low test scores, the former superintendent, Bill Rojas, fired the principal and fired half of the teachers at Mission High School and, you know, then brought in expensive consultants and outsiders to turn it around. And this was one of many similar efforts in the past. And by the time teachers who I profile in the book came to school in 2001, Mission High School had some of the lowest test scores in the district. There were student protests, and more teachers were leaving Mission High School than any other school in the district. So then finally, in 2001, while the rest of the country was intensifying its top-down reforms with No Child Left Behind, San Francisco Unified tried something different, and they empowered their teachers. So they supported a small group of experienced teacher leaders to come up with reforms of their own. And they look very different than the top-down approach. You know, there's many things that go into it, but if I could just focus kind of on three that I think are the most important, is first of all, they design their programs around to provide opportunities sort of for intense focus on their craft. So they increase time for teachers to plan lessons together, to analyze student outcomes, but also observe classrooms, walk through classrooms, interview students, interview teachers, and look at a variety of quantitative but also qualitative data to make decisions about the root causes of achievement gaps in this particular school, and then they can sit down and collectively design a plan. There's also an intense focus on race and equity issues, so teachers constantly disaggregate all sorts of data, you know, grades and attendance and referrals. That means, you know, how many students are sent out of class. They look at access to AP and honors classes, and they're constantly trying to figure out, okay, why do certain disparities exist in our school? And try to address those. And finally, when you put teachers in charge, what you get is you get a curriculum that's not designed around standards, top-down standards kind of imposed by the outsiders, but they design lessons around the interests and experiences and passions of their students. They're constantly paying attention to the engagement or lack of engagement in a classroom and then adjust their lesson plans accordingly.
Yeah. Now, you show many examples of students' work. And in fact, in many ways, it felt to me like this is a school as much about, this is a book, Mission High, this is a book as much about teaching as it is about a school itself and a certain approach. You show a lot of examples of students' work that is really quite extraordinary. I was impressed by many, but tell us about Jasmine.
Jasmine was one of the first students I met in Mission High School, and you know she's an incredibly astute, brilliant African American student who grew up in one of the most struggling neighborhoods in our city. It's a historical African American community, Bayview Hunters Point, and she lives in public housing. You know, she's raised by a single mom who often works 2-3 jobs. And Jasmine also grew up witnessing definitely a lot of she experienced a lot of loss in her family. Her father was killed in an accident. A couple of her friends were shot while she was growing up. And at the end of high school, her best friend and her boyfriend was shot and killed, which really derailed her from her path to college. So she's definitely, on the one hand, she's one of the most struggling students and, you know, represents a lot of typical stories in urban schools. But on the other hand, she's this incredibly resilient and brilliant student whose story illustrates how what needs to happen to help students like Jasmine succeed. So Jasmine would often contrast her experiences in middle school versus high school. She went to a high-performing middle school in one of the most affluent districts in San Francisco, in the Marina District. And she was one of 6 African-American students there, and she had mostly Fs and Ds there. She was flagged by the district of, you know, risk of dropping out. And she said that she basically felt that teachers at that school didn't know how to work with African-American students. They didn't care if they needed extra support, and they either, when Jasmine had extra questions in the class, they would either ignore her or treat it as a disruption rather than a wish to engage with the material. So by the time she got to Mission, Jasmine was doing much better, and you know, in the 11th grade, I watched her present 2 papers. The first one was She did an oral history of her community. Her community was from the South, and they migrated to the Bay Area. And she talked to her boyfriend's grandmother about the Great Migration, but also about growing up in Tulsa and witnessing some of the worst race riots in our history that happened in 1921 in Tulsa. And she interviewed her about her experiences of growing up there and what the community was like, and educated, you know, her classmates and myself included, even though I'm a history major, she educated me about that time in our history. And then I, about 6 months later, Trayvon Martin got killed in Florida, and Jasmine was on her spring break, but she insisted that she really wanted to switch her research topic and focus on this issue. And so she wrote this incredibly sophisticated paper about the root causes in achievement gaps, and that then essentially lead, you know, to higher suspensions of African American students, and then higher rates of incarceration among African American young teens, but also of course adults. So you know, when I asked Jasmine, what was it different about Mission High that allowed her to thrive and succeed? She said that, first of all, it's obvious that at Mission High School, there are a lot of conversations that happen among teachers around what does it take to successfully educate all students in the school, right? And what does it take to help struggling African American students in particular? And she said that It's often about sort of small, specialized skills or changes in your affect. You know, she said, for example, how one of the most important things that set aside effective teachers at Mission High School who succeed with African-American students is they don't look at Jasmine as a person who has all these problems, you know, violent neighborhood and experience with violence within a family, or, you know, a past record of D's and F's and low test scores. That's not what dominates their view of the student. Teachers work very hard at Mission High School to notice all of the strengths and the potential of their student every day. So a lot of teachers actually at Mission don't even know about a lot of these issues that Jasmine told me personally, because what they focus on is they focus on her work. They provide a lot of opportunities for her to show her intellect, participate in discussions. They look at her student work, but they don't spend, you know, hours and hours talking about all of her family and neighborhood problems. So some of it has to do with affect, and a lot of it just has to do with strong skills to know how to work with students that have different level of skills and motivation, and knowing how to help them, you know, improve their writing, improve their vocabulary, and increase their academic confidence.
Yeah, and a lot of this teaching is actually based in neuroscience. You have a very interesting discussion in the book, Christina Rizga, in your wonderful book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. Such a true and wonderfully descriptive title. What's the neuroscience that backs up this approach to teaching?
Yes. So there's so much, we're learning so much about how students learn and what works in learning and teaching. And I would say one of the most striking findings is that you know, students don't learn when it's a kind of a teacher-driven sort of top-down classroom where, you know, in so many classrooms, teachers to this day continue to mostly talk and lecture, and maybe at the end of the class there's an assignment, an activity, or a lot of these activities are assigned as homework. And there's not, in many classrooms, there's not that much variation in terms of activities. What the research in neuroscience tells us is that students learn in the long term when they're allowed to engage with the material emotionally and intellectually and from a variety of formats and perspectives. So this again gets at to, you know, into kind of the craft of teaching, but some of the most effective classrooms in Mission High School, and, you know, effective teachers, neuroscience now is sort of confirming what experienced teachers have known from wisdom and evidence for decades. But it's really great that we now have neuroscience behind this. But the most effective teachers set up classrooms that have a variety of activities. There's a mini lecture. There is an opportunity to reflect on what students just read or heard in small groups or in larger groups. Then there's usually it's followed by a collective discussion. There are a variety of written assignments. You know, you're not just going to sit and practice the same skill over and over again until you're bored to death. You know, there will be, you know, in Ms. McKinney's class, you're going to respond to short questions about the article you just read. Then you might do a quick warm-up exercise in analysis as you prepare to work on a larger research paper. There's going to be a quick, fun vocabulary exercise. In other words, there's a variety of activities because science tells us the students don't, after 15 minutes of the same thing, most students, high school and college, tune out. This is what teachers refer to as the rhythm and the pace of class, right? The number of activities and how are they sequenced and how long each of these activities last. And this is really kind of gets at the heart of these specialized skills that teachers need to have to set up effective classrooms that teach skills, but also are intellectually engaging.
Now, let's see, where do I want to go with this? yeah, you mentioned how diverse a school is, and I'd like to, this is another, I think, very important part of this book, Mission High, is to talk about how diversity is celebrated, you know, very, very much in opposition to standardization, diversity is celebrated. I was very moved by the story you tell of Pablo and his speech at the school. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about him and how, you know, this is a case where it's not diversity around race, but diversity around gender, around sexual orientation.
Pablo is a courageous gay student and activist from Guatemala who moved to the United States in 2008, and he was incredibly shy. He was a math nerd. He barely spoke English, and over the course of 4 years, I watched him blossom into one of the most incredible and inspiring activists and leaders I've encountered in my life. And I think his story shows so much how a school can be set up as a place that brings out the best in students, you know, helps them get to know themselves, and through their stories in their life, kind of teaches very important messages about social inclusion and acceptance to other students. So first of all, there's a very strong support from the teachers at Mission High School for the Gay Straight Alliance clubs. But there's also a lot of other clubs that Pablo joined that explicitly throughout the school celebrate diversity and celebrate the positive things that come from that. Then there's a lot of training for teachers how to create classrooms that, you know, there's zero tolerance for any sort of racial slurs or homophobia or sexism, and very, you know, explicit rules about how teachers respond to that, but also how teachers themselves model values of inclusion and acceptance and standing up for others. But then there's also, you know, throughout the school, teachers spend a lot of time thinking about what kind of content they're going to use and include in English classes, in math classes, in chemistry classes that will reference the stories and the experiences of the students that they're educating and that will allow them to engage in conversations and discussions that, again, promote the values of diversity and acceptance. And I think what, you know, Pablo's story illustrates, you know, he went from being one of the most bullied young people in Guatemala and then, you know, having a similar experience at First Admission to someone who created one of the most effective gay-straight student alliances in the country. And in fact, the Admission has very relatively few bullying instances. There are, compared nationally, one in five gay students report being bullied, and those numbers are much, much lower at Mission. But I think Pablo's story illustrates how hard it is going to be for our country to reduce bullying or racism, right, or exclusion of anything in a school that is homogenous or segregated. This is where the value of a diverse school, I think, become most visible, right? Because we can read all the stories and books we want about the harm of racism or the causes of racism, but there's nothing like spending, you know, 4 years in a diverse school and learning from personal experiences of other students and understanding what it means to stand up for others, what it means to have an inclusive community, and what you gain as a human being from being surrounded by that diversity.
Now, this is a wonderful contrast in many ways to, of course, what has become the dominant paradigm of top-down education, the so-called standards and accountability movement. You take square aim at test scores as a measure of student learning. And in fact, you say, you charge that America's, this is, I'm quoting from your book, Mission High, Christina Rizga. Your book says, America's business-inspired obsession with prioritizing metrics is the primary cause of mediocrity in American schools. Deconstruct that sentence for us.
Yes, I really, after having spent 4 years at Mission High School and also having studied how other high-performing countries, what they prioritize is increased achievement, I strongly believe that now. And it has to do with the fact that in the United States, the people who dominate education reforms, who have dominated education reforms 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and today, come primarily from business. You know, and today they come primarily from business community, and that includes tech community. And I think that, and I was, you know, I was in the same boat with them 5 years ago before I got to Mission High School. They're essentially insisting, you know, there's got to be a way to measure learning and measure the value the teachers add. And so we're going to really focus on creating systems that help us measure that and track progress. And then schools that can show measurable progress will be the model for how change should happen in every other school in the country. The reality is, of course, so much more complicated, but also interesting. And you know, we don't hear about it very much because we just, in this country, we don't really talk to teachers and students all that much. We mostly hear from business and tech community. And, you know, when a layperson listens to their ideas and solutions, it kind of makes sense. It sounds interesting. It's intuitive. It's something that we can understand versus, you know, talking to Ms. McKamey about the rhythm and the pace of the class, you know, and morphology and these very complex pedagogical things that, you know, for most people, they're just eyes glazed over and they're done with that conversation. But essentially, you know, what I found out is that some of the most important things that matter in a quality education and that help students succeed at Mission High School, things like emotional intellectual engagement with our content, ability to problem solve, ability to communicate effectively and collaborate with others, curiosity, creativity, resilience, all of these things that science today tell us actually are some of the most important things that increase achievement, but they cannot be measured by standardized test scores. These are the things that increase achievement the most, but they're very hard to quantify in a standardized manner. And so in most classes in the United States, they're overlooked, especially in schools that, like Mission High School, educate high numbers of struggling students because the pressures on these schools to focus on test scores are much greater than a school that educates affluent students. But I've reported in so many other schools over the course of my 5 years writing for this book and Mother Jones magazine, and I see, you know, hear the same story from affluent and low-performing schools, that the emphasis is so much on standards and standardized tests, and that means that teachers kind of design everything around that rather than these other harder-to-detect things that are invisible to the outsiders and that matter in the quality education. So, and with each year, since No Child Left Behind, the pressures to focus on that have been greater and greater. And again, it makes intuitive sense to outsiders and me also 5 years ago. And today I see how that's just the wrong approach. And no other high-performing country, you know, like Finland or South Korea or Singapore, place so much emphasis on standardized testing. We have more standardized tests in our schools than any other industrialized country, nor does any other high-performing country invest so much money into creating these tests, you know, measuring students and also measuring teachers. All these other countries are emphasizing building up the capacity of teachers to do that kind of bottom-up work that I described in the beginning of your program, right, where teachers themselves look at the local data, including the kind that, you know, cannot be measured but can be detected by a professional who understands pedagogy, who understands child psychology, who understands, you know, teenage brain and how they learn their specific subjects. They can see that stuff. They can detect it. But a business person or a tech, you know, superstar is never going to be able to see that.
Yeah, and teachers have been made scapegoats, whereas your book, Mission High, really points out that what you call teacher-driven and student-focused education is really the key to success. This is just an amazing book. It has beautiful stories. It was inspiring to read. It really restores faith in the ability of common sense to have really good educational outcomes. I want to thank you so much, Christina Rizga, for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca. Thank you so much for reading it so closely and highlighting the student stories especially. That's why I wrote the book, and I hope that, you know, we can learn from their stories and their wisdom. So thank you so much for having me on your show.
Christina Rizga writes about education for Mother Jones magazine. She's also written for The Nation and the LA Times, among others. She co-founded the Baltic Center for Investigative Journalism, based in her homeland, Latvia. Find links to her articles about education at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.